come to find out, my buddy walked on board the wrong ship. He wakes up in medical on the one of the ships that was pierside. And he was a liberty restriction. So, you know, liberty restrictions are those guys that got to be back by like 9 o'clock. So nobody wanted to hang out with him because it's like, dude, man, you got to be back by 9, man. So he was like the kid with lice. Everybody was kind of ducking him on the way for every port afterwards. We're like, dude, you got to check out with this guy, but man, he's got to be back by 9. It's like Cinderella liberty, man.
You're listening to Barrack Stories, the podcast that inspires veterans to share their stories. My name is Alan Murphy, and I'm a former U.S. Navy air crewman that still struggles with the transition out of the military. And I'm sitting down with military veterans to talk about their memorable moments from the barracks, from training, and from deployment.
This episode, I sit down with Jose. Joined active duty Navy back in September 11th of 1991, and then transitioned to the Naval Reserve in 95, working with Naval Special Warfare. But after the attacks on 9/11, 10 years later, he was back on active duty, off and on for 18 years to support the global war on terror.
So we met through the Mission Continues. Weirdly enough, I also had you as my Secret Santa. I think I have that notebook in my bag. If not, it's in my desk.
I still have that. That's right.
Can you say out loud the quote? Because it's about steering the ship.
Oh, brother, let me tell you, my memory is some of the it's all kind of mishmashed. We were talking about this on the drive up. My memory is horrible. I remember I put a quote in there, but I don't remember what it was.
Well, then I'll say it out loud. So it's a real leader. Anybody can drive the ship, but it takes a real leader to chart the course.
Bam.
I look at that at least once a week, if not once a day.
Nice.
It's been a decent quote. So we had Secret Santa, Mission Continues. We deployed to Detroit for 10 days, which felt like an eternity.
Mission Continues, yes, yeah. For Operation Motown.
And then it continued on to Texas, where we met up again through the Student Veterans of America. Weirdly enough,
the national conference.
You know, we both have a very good mutual friend in common, you know, retired Chief Jesse Tosetti. If I didn't say chief, he'd get super upset with me.
That's so right. He's still in the chief's mess, the goat locker.
Yeah. Unfortunately, and your friend here just goes, "No, fuck that guy." Yeah. That's exact. Oh, you were a chief. Oh, uh-huh. But you're not an asshole like Jesse.
Ah, that's terrible. Old Jesse. We'll see him at the next Student Veterans of America National Conference.
Yeah. Now he has to go.
2019.
So we've known each other for, I'm almost like, what, 2 years now, right? 2016?
Was that Operation Motown 2016? Yeah.
It feels much longer than that.
Because we run in the same circles.
Yeah, which is awesome. I didn't realize you did comedian work. So it's always nice to catch up and see what
you have to plug ASAP, please. The Armed Services Art Partnership, a 501c3 that teaches comedy boot camp, improv, and creative writing classes to veterans in the community, military-affiliated folks, and active duty people.
And spouses, yeah.
And spouses, yes. Military-affiliated families.
I think spouses have some
good stories. To share their stories.
Yeah.
Share their stories and engage with their art community locally.
So we, again, like you said, we are in a lot of mutual circles in everything that we do. So to start off the podcast, why'd you join the military?
I joined the military because I knew after high school, I was not going to be going anywhere like college or the university. I hadn't taken any SATs. I did take an ASVAB, and I actually ended up having to do some community hours for doing some bad stuff because I was a bad kid when I was young. And I ended up doing these community hours at a Navy recruiting station. But when I was a high school senior, I decided I was going to go join the Army and drive tanks. And after doing all those community hours and trying to figure out exactly how I was going to get into the Army, I was 17 at the time. My parents had passed away. My dad passed away the junior year. My mom passed away before my senior year. So I was 17 and I knew I had to do something. So I was hustling to really figure out what that something was. And I knew it was going to be, I didn't know what it was going to be. So I went into the military down that road. And the appeal was really to just drive tanks and blow stuff up and run stuff over. But one of those folks that I was in that recruiting station with doing those community hours at the time had caught up with me while I was waiting outside the Army office during one of those meetings. waiting on the Army recruiter, and he said, "Hey, who are you? I remember your face." And he called me in there and he said, "Well, what are you doing?" And he's like, "Well, I'm gonna join the Army. I'm gonna drive tanks, blow shit up." And he's like, "Well, what are you gonna do after that?" And I said, I don't know. So he said, "Why don't you look at some Navy jobs?" And so I went in and I looked at some Navy jobs, and they offered me something really technical, and I took that, and I ended up going that road. And they said, "Well, you know what? I can't sign a contract. I'm still 17. And I was like, "If you want to go into the Navy, we'll figure that part out." And back in those days, I guess they just figured it out and they got me in there. So,
what year was this?
91. 1991.
Pre 9/11.
Yeah,
no pre 9/11. No war is going on. Persian Gulf just ended.
Yep. Yeah, the Gulf, actually, when I left on September 11th, 1991.
Wow.
And the Gulf War, the Desert Storm 1 kind of started and stopped around that time. You know, that was a quick, I don't know, what was it, 60 days, 30, right. 60, 90 days right. before it went from the mother of all battles to, hey, that's a wrap. So when I was going off to boot camp, that would happen.
Did you have in your family any sort of military impact? Did anybody in your military, anybody in your family served in the military at all?
No, nobody. Okay. Nobody in my family. I had a cousin that was in the Navy for, I think, a little bit before he got in trouble. And yeah, he was out of there. But even then, I liked the idea while he was there. He joined the Navy. He was in San Diego and he was off in Japan. And then I think he had a little bit too much of whatever they got going on out there at the time. And he was in and out. And he was the only guy that I knew that even, I ever saw in a uniform.
Mm-hmm. You go to boot camp September 11th. Mm-hmm. Walk me through your boot camp experience. What was that initial first few hours?
Well, boot camp, it's so long ago now. So when I think of boot camp, my biggest takeaway from boot camp was, here's all these people from every corner. And, growing up in Queens, you knew people from all over the place. You got folks from South America, Europe, Italians, Germans, Jews, Central America. But when you get to boot camp in the military, you got people from the four corners of the country. And I remember a guy who was a gangbanger, a guy who was an Eskimo from like Alaska who was in boot camp, another guy who was a cowboy, like a no shit real cowboy.
Wrangling cows.
Really, like a straight up cowboy. Like he was there because, I had no idea what a cowboy was, but yeah, he worked on a ranch. And
there's you from New York.
And then there was me. Actually, at the time, I joined in Miami.
Okay.
Yeah, but and then there was me from New York and Miami. And I was there in the mix with the rest of these cats and dogs. And boot camp came and went, and it was pretty interesting. We were one of the last classes to go through the boot camp in San Diego before they shut the place down.
Oh, now it's in Chicago or Great Lakes.
Lakes, yeah. After that, it turned into condos or whatever it is over there now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You go through boot camp. Usually you go straight to A school. Where'd you go?
I went home for 30 days and then came back. And then I went to A school back in San Diego. I went to the school right there at RTC, NTC, if anybody remembers that stuff, right there in San Diego. And I spent, I don't know what it was, 24, 26 weeks at ICA school. And a lot of that I spent, it was great. The best time was just being able to go to school and then spend a lot of time in Mexico during that time. It was wide open. You'd take a $5 shuttle from the base and they drop you off and you cross a turnstile and all of a sudden you were in Mexico. I thought it was amazing.
ICA school is, what's that stand for?
Oh, I see Interior Communications.
So what is that now? What's the new rate?
Man, ICmen have always been that rate that the Navy's been wanting to get away from. And I think, I don't know if they've killed it yet, but they kind of took the IC job and took it out of engineering and they've made them operations folks. So now they work out of the island as opposed to the engine room. And instead of hanging out, nine decks down, they're, six levels up or whatever.
So what is it? That could be the OSs now?
Well, they kind of work in the same division now. The same department, I'll say.
So what we're referring to an OS is operations specialist. They do a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. I loved working with OSs when I was in the Navy. So they were just cool folks because they didn't treat themselves like they were boat donkeys on a boat. Very different.
No, it was a great experience. I did that and I got to, you got the whole fleet experience, but I was on board an amphib ship with some really mad people because the guys that, by the time I got to a ship.
This right after A school?
Yeah, right after A school. These guys had been on a deployment. It was the USS Saipan, and these guys had been on a deployment. they got rolled into Desert Storm, and then like a year later, they were back on deployment. So if it, within that 4-year span, they had been on like 3 deployments and work ops.
That's a lot of.
And those
for
guys
Navy ship, that's
just,
a lot of. That's a lot of.
Time it was the most underway activity in the Navy at the time, and those guys. And I'm going there for the first time, a new guy, and those guys were just mad at the world. So that was my first experience with the Navy.
Going back to A school, do you, besides Mexico, or even including Mexico, any funny, memorable, hilarious moments, stories from that time?
A school? Yeah. I remember the first week you got there, everybody had to take a test to make sure you belonged there. And if you failed it, you had to come back for some remedial thing. And the whole class just decided we were all going to Mexico. And then halfway down there, we really realized that half of us had to be back for this remedial thing. So we had to turn around. And then the rest of us kind of did the remedial thing and then ended up in Tijuana at the end of the night. And at the time, I don't know what they paid you back then, like $125 for a paycheck or something. I don't know what it was, an E2, an E3. And I was actually, I blew whatever money I had down there. And I was stuck down there, a little inebriated with no money. And I lost all the people I went down there with. So I was in a bad situation in one of these places down in Mexico until I ran into the friend I originally left the base with. And then he kind of took me under his wing. He was from LA. And I ended up just kind of hanging out with him the rest of the night. He got me back to the base. So that was interesting.
But no, any other funny stories from the barracks?
From A school? No, I remember on the way out, it was kind of a neat little base. It was like the old architecture. But I remember always on the way out, we'd hit the exchange and we'd hit the spray bottles at the cologne station in the exchange. And that would be like our ritual before we went out. And normally just hanging out. First thing we do was like hit the exchange on the way out, get like your smell good on, and then we'd head on down to the shuttle down to Tijuana or catch the bus down there. Or whatever,
that's hilarious.
Just get dumped on the border and hang out. And that was like 5 days a week. It's amazing I made it through all that stuff.
5 days a week in Mexico.
It was a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday type of thing. It was just right after school, me and this other guy would just roll down there and just that's where we hung out.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, it was fun.
Graduate A school.
Mm-hmm.
Straight to your ship. What ship?
Yeah, it's a USS Saipan.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is was that LHD?
LHA.
Okay.
LHA.
Which is for those that don't know, that is basically the second biggest ship in the Navy, right? It's basically an aircraft carrier for
helicopters.
It's an
amphibious ship.
Right.
Yeah.
It's designed to carry 3,000 Marines,
mm-hmm.
deploy them, and bring them back home.
Dump them on the beach. Yeah. Yep, that's what we did. A lot of gator squares in the ocean and
gator squares, yes. Up.
Yeah, driving around.
Deep, 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 yeah.
Yep.
Walk me through your time on that ship.
Oh, so it was very interesting. You get to the ship, and I go to one of these shops on the ship. It was like a tiny space, probably about the size of maybe twice the size of a walk-in closet. And I walk in there, and there's like 9 guys in there watching a little VCR television in the dark, watching Penitentiary 3, one of these old school movies. And I show up in my whites. I don't know what day it was, but it was like the whole duty section was in there. And I said, man, there's a lot of dudes in this space. It was just guys were just crammed in, sitting on the floor, sitting on a workbench, sitting on top of stuff. And they're all just sitting in there like it was it literally was like a prison cell. And they're just sitting in there watching Penitentiary 3 or 4, one of these penitentiary movies. And I was like, what the hell did I just sign up for? You know, and this is what my day's going to look like or my nights. And these cats were just in there watching that. And I was just like, what the hell? And then they moved me into like the marine berthing because I didn't have a space in engineering and I lived in there. And that was all well and good. You know, it was at the time I was miserable, but you know, you're living on a brack.
Why were you so miserable? Were you getting homesick? What was going through your mind?
Yeah. You know, you get there, you don't know anybody. These guys are miserable because they just got off like their second deployment and they're getting ready for their third deployment in a 4-year stretch. They're doing workups. They're getting underway and doing all this stuff. For me, it was my first experience, so I really didn't know. I had nothing to compare it to. But these other guys, they were just salty. Salty, 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 salty.
Salty referring to just the time spent out to sea, and you get all crusty and mean and just salty.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Salty. You got to experience deck plate leadership. I only say that because there's a chief in here.
Yeah. I don't know. That was, I want to call it that. It was like, you know, the old school Navy, I guess, is what it was. So it's dudes.
What, how do you describe the old school Navy?
It was like, you know, everybody says, man, back in my day. But now I'm not talking about my day, but the guys that were saying back in my day were guys that were in there in the 80s and like maybe have gotten in the late 70s or something. So these were some really salty dudes back when the Navy was just different back then. So these guys were all my chiefs and first classes, and they were on their way out. So it was just a different kind of Navy back then. And
how many deployments did you do on that ship?
Oh, just one.
So walk me through your that first deployment then.
That first deployment, Operation Provide Promise and the Desert Storm, Desert Shield thing was going on, the first one. So we were picking up and dumping Marines at all these places. They do exercises.
Where exactly? Off the coast of America or overseas?
Oh,
in the
no,
Gulf?
No.
Like where?
Yeah, they would be, we'd drop them off. Let's see. They went to Israel. They went to Africa. We dropped them off, I think, somewhere in Iraq at the time, I believe. They would do air ops off of, Kosovo at the time because they were providing, what do they call that? A air embargo, doing the whole Operation Provide Promise, sort of providing security for what was going on over there during the genocide. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I was oblivious. I did my thing on the ship, and that was the extent of it. But that was it. We'd pull into ports and things like that. We pulled into Israel. We pulled into Palma.
Where'd you pull into Israel?
Rota, Haifa.
Haifa,
Israel.
I pulled into Haifa.
Haifa was
good
great.
Time.
And the great thing about Haifa, I think we were there for like 3 weeks or something because the ship, something broke on the ship. And yeah, we were there till something got fixed. You know, at that age, you're just kind of going with the flow. You don't know too much. You know, I think maybe I wasn't. Third class or something. So, But Haifa was really interesting. There were stuff going on, like people were blowing themselves up on buses. But again, totally oblivious to any of that stuff. You know, it's the first time I got a taste of that cafe culture where you just kind of hang out at some place and nobody bothered you and you just could sit there for hours. And I remember doing that for the first time. And
Haifa, you definitely can do that. There's tons of awesome cafes there.
Yeah, you just hang out and do that stuff, and I kind of took it in. I mean, you know, you had your time off, so that was a good time.
Do you go to Jerusalem, Tel Aviv? And you get to travel outside of Haifa?
No, the only big, when we pulled into Greece, I did some stuff there. I went diving in Greece.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but Haifa was just like really just hanging out there and, you know, the usual clubs and bars. This was like 93. So, you know, you just ran the streets and ran into places to find out and get in trouble and stuff like that. So that was
a
good
pulled
time.
Into Haifa, you pulled in, or rather Israel, pulled into Greece. Where else, you said?
Greece, Palma, Rota, Spain, and I think that was it. Sigonella, I believe we popped on there. All the usual, you know, med cruise spots and stuff. So that was.
So it was a total med cruise.
It was the total med cruise experience, along with like the little things that would pop off that we would, you know, support. And then we would go up the Adriatic and provide support for Provide Promise, which was the operation going on up there. To kind of, I mean, these are the type of things I only kind of did the research on later on and find out, oh, that's what was going on.
Yeah.
You know. But it was pretty interesting, yeah.
Any funny, memorable stories from that deployment?
From that deployment, it was, I mean, you know, you're going to all these places for the first time. There was a guy in the shop that he got thrown through like a plate glass window at a country bar. I remember that. And this guy, he was actually a cop from New York. But prior to that, he was a policeman in New York before he joined the Navy and got in some kind of trouble. And I remember hearing it before I saw it, and I look over and I was like, wow, did somebody just get thrown through that window? And then I thought, holy shit, I know who that was. And it was, you know, it was one of our guys. It was one of the dudes that we knew. So it was just kind of nuts to see. But that was just sort of, you're just sort of a spectator, you know, you're 19, 20 years old and all that stuff is going down and you're just like, you know, you're just an observer of all of it, you know, so.
Guy throws thrown the plane glass.
Yeah. And then later on.
So that's an incredible story. What other drunken nights?
Oh, man. You know, that back in those days, I think it was just sort of like what happened on deployment at those places. Like those guys, it was just par for the course. What kicked it off is when we first pulled into, what is it, Naples. I remember we're all leaving the fleet landing and I'm looking out ahead of me And I see this guy get hit by a car, one of the Marines in front of me. And he goes, and it's one of these little tiny like Italian cars. And he goes, boom, goes over the hood, over the top of the car, falls to the street. And he kind of gets up and brushes himself off. And the guy sticks his head out the window. He's like, hey, like in Italian, he's like, hey, you okay? You okay? And the guy's like, yeah, I think I'm all right. And he's like, oh, good, good, good. And he just takes off. And the dude like really went over the hood of this thing. I was like, whoa, where does that happen? But it was just sort of par for the course for that place, you know. And then later that night, I think the Marines and the Navy guys got into a fight over something or other. And the whole club just turned into like this World War II movie where it was like guys were just swinging and throwing stuff. And, you know, like I said, I'm just a spectator of all this mess. I'm just there kind of taking it all in and be like, wow, what did I sign myself into?
I remember when I was a spectator seeing this, I typically egged on people.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever
do the what?
Egg on
people. Oh, like, egg on.
Dude,
yeah.
Dude, he's saying shit about your mom. You should probably go fuck him up.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was that. And then there's one guy, you know, you're connecting with all these guys on the ship, on the chop over across in the Atlantic. I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. When we pull in, we're going to hang out. And one of these guys, he got so hammered, like right out the gate, that he was like a Weekend at Bernie's kind of drunk, just like that we just dragged around the whole night like a dead body. And it was the entire night we dragged this guy around. And we're like, man, this guy's just not getting sober. And then we finally make it at the end of the night. I don't know what it was, like 2 o'clock in the morning. We get back to Fleet Landing where the Liberty boat is.
Yeah.
And we plop him down and we're like, okay, man, just breathe, hang out by this fountain. And we asked this guy, we're like, hey, can you just watch him? We're going to go get some McDonald's and come back. And me and this other guy that were watching him, we kind of go off and try to find this fast food joint, McDonald's, to try to get something to eat. And when we come back, he's gone. So we're like, all right, maybe he's back on board the ship. So we went back out, you know, hung out some more. I go back to berthing and I'm like, let me make sure this guy, you know, you look out for your boys. So I'm looking to make sure this guy got in his rack, and I look and he's not in his rack. And I'm like, oh, now it's like 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, well, maybe he's in the shop. And when I go down the ladder, 9 decks to like the forward and aft IC, and he's not down there. And I'm like, oh, man, maybe he's in the card shop, 02 level. So I'm walking all over the place like a little, like worried for this guy. And I'm not feeling all that great either. I finally pass out. I'm like, I don't know where this dude is. And like, lo and behold, I see my first class like putting his whites on. I'm like, man, what time is it? Lights are still off. Come to find out, my buddy walked on board the wrong ship. He wakes up in medical on the one of the ships that was Pierside. And then he was like, you know, he went to restriction and captain's mass and all that stuff.
For walking on the wrong ship?
Oh, he woke up drunk on the wrong ship is what happened. They drug him. He kind of just, you know, went on the brow and they took him straight to medical and come to find out, he woke up and the first class was there. And he was a Liberty restriction. So, you know, Liberty restrictions are those guys that got to be back by like 9 o'clock. So nobody wanted to hang out with him because it's like, dude, man, you got to be back by 9, man. So he was like the kid with lice. Everybody was kind of ducking him on the way for every port afterwards. We're like, dude, you got to check out with this guy. But, man, he's got to be back by 9. It's like Cinderella Liberty, man. So, and that was for the rest of the deployment and then some. So it was pretty interesting. So, yeah, there was that.
That's great. That's funny. I have not heard of the term Cinderella Liberty in such a long time.
Cinderella, before you turn back into a pumpkin, you better get back. get back before you turn back into a pumpkin, man.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Everybody has those drunken stories. Mm-hmm. Did you ever have anybody clamshelled on your boat?
Clamshelled? No. What was that?
Where you take two litters. So usually it's... let me paint a picture for those listening. Have never heard of what a clamshell is. Mm. You've got a drunken sailor on a quarterdeck being unruly, and you don't know how to restrain them because you're not allowed to put them in handcuffs. So what you're allowed to do is take two litters, and literally clamshell the person together,
yeah,
cinch it down, and then carry them to the rack. Call it a day. Did you ever see anybody clamshelled?
That's hilarious. That sounds like... No, I didn't. But we did tie people up, like, you know, the whole birthday thing. The whole duct tape thing that was kind of like, not necessarily hazing, but God forbid somebody found out it was your birthday. I remember my first class, it was his birthday around Christmas time, and we were just sitting around duty section bored, and we're like, yeah, we're duct taping this dude. So we got the chain fall out, and we got him. We got him good. You know, the old duct tape. I mean, that was somebody, I got a retired Master Chief I just work with now, and I just had a birthday recently, and you know, years later, he's like, hey man, I heard it was your birthday, I'm getting the duct tape. And I was like, whoa, what do you know about I mean, it's a Navy thing, I think, you know, the whole I mean, I know the Marine Corps is big on it too, so that's a birthday tradition.
I also have to ask on the side pan, how many relationships did you see developing?
Well, three, because there was three females that came on board during my time there, like the first females to be on an amphib ship.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and you know, that just went south. The first females I remember back in that time were coming on board the ship, and two of them went, I think one or two of them went straight to engineering. And
that's a bad idea.
It's just, and the engineering crowd was just a rough place to be. Like, it was, of all the folks on the ship, the engineering guys are just like a little bit of the saltier sort. And she didn't do too well down there, but it's just tough, you know. And then you got it's just kind of predatory being some of the first women to be on board a ship, and you got these salty dogs that are just coming out of the woodwork and chasing you down like they've never seen a woman before. So yeah, that was just a little bit of calamity. It's a different Navy now. That was, you know,
yeah.
When women were first being introduced, so there was that.
Nope. So you finished that deployment. Mm-hmm. When did you get back?
Got back, I guess that was like 94. Did my deployment. We did some shipyard stuff, and then I got out, and then I ended up in the reserves.
Interesting. Okay. Yep. When did you get out of the Navy?
Part of it was I wanted to do something else. I kind of made and this is for any veteran out there, kind of make your wish list, your 1 year, 5 year, 10 year plan. And at the time I was like, you know what? I'm ready to move on to something else. I did my thing. It really wasn't, you know, like I said, I had some really salty people I was working with. And I said, you know, let me do something different. I went out, got out, but I still kind of missed something about the Navy. So I ended up rolling over to becoming a CB. And I went to the reserve side.
I think that's what I thought is. I always thought you were a CB.
I was an ICman, which is like an engineer in the fleet. And then I rolled over to be a CB.
When did you roll over? When you were in the reserves?
I went into reserves with the CB vet program, they called it, where they would take things like ETs and EMs and ICman, and they would make them a CB rate at the time.
What CB rate were you?
I was a CE, construction electrician. At the time.
So you focused on what specifically?
Oh, so CEs, we kind of did, they broke it up. So you got to go to two schools. You went to the school in Port Hueneme, and then you go to the school in Biloxi. And the first half of the school, you'd actually do like power distribution lines. So you had to learn how to climb poles, like power transfer poles.
Is there a name for that? People that climb poles?
Pole climbers? I don't know. But at the time, man, I'm talking about, I'd get squeamish about it, but you had 2 weeks of this stuff, learning how to do it the old school way, learning how to climb poles with the little spikes on your feet. I forgot what they called those things now. It's been so long. But yeah, you learned it the old school way. You learned how to hoist stuff up there and climb up there. I actually fell off one of those damn things, belted in. And
wait, what?
Yeah. We were in the pole field where you kind of practice just moving up and down this pole.
I just want to make sure, because there's a lot of innuendos being thrown out time. There is a field of large, thick poles.
Oh, indeed there is.
And you're climbing these.
Yep, my CB poles. Brothers out there know what I'm talking about. You have a whole week of just climbing and learning how to move around on, you know, look at your power poles out there, your distribution lines and your power lines, and that's what you did. You learned how to work your way up there and bring up stuff, yard arms and stuff like that, and learn how to work that mess. So that was that. And on the tail end of it, and I was a class leader. I forgot about that part. Yeah, I was a second class by then. And the instructor was like, hey, you know, why don't you practice just getting up there and moving around on the pole and, you know, bringing the equipment up, like, you know, transformers and stuff like that. And after a whole day of people digging into this pole, there were big gaps in it. So my little spike just kicked out and I'm belted in. So my face, like a cartoon, just slid right down that pole, and I caught just nothing but splinters and, you know, and then like a cartoon, like that spike kicked back in like 3 feet from the bottom. So I had my ankle up by my ear, and then the rest of me was just dangling down, kind of belted into this pole. And I was good after that. I was just kind of done. But it was good. I passed the course. They made me I got to keep my rate, and it was good. And then I was very lucky that I got to chop over to Naval Special Warfare on the reserve side. And that was about like 96, 97.
Which team were you attached to for Naval Special Warfare?
At the time, they didn't have a particular team. It was just all detachments.
So you were support. You were totally support, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, even the team guys that were reservists at the time were all detachments, and they kind of mustered in different places. They went through a couple different... I was there for 18 years in NSW, so I saw this evolution from when the NSW used to deploy team or platoons to when they actually deployed the whole command. And at the time, we had reserve detachments where it was either the technicians or the team guys would go over to Teal Team 4. And at the time, it was sort of like a wild, wild west where they would just plug you in wherever they needed you. And I remember my first CO, Captain Keeney, was he was Jesse Ventura's swim buddy and buds. And he was something else. He stops me in the in the hallway one time, and he's like, "Jose, you speak Spanish?" And I was like, "Yeah, I speak Spanish." He's like, "Hey, you want to go to El Salvador?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'll go to El Salvador." He's like, "Go talk to this chief over here." So, and then they would just type you up orders and they shoot you out there, and all of a sudden I got to do counter drug stuff and out of the embassy and in a narcotics base working in El Salvador, and that was like,
holy shit, really?
Yeah. It was like because
how
I spoke
long were
Spanish.
For?
Oh, about a month.
So it you were translating, building.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, would
most
you really
of it
do that?
Was
what you can at least tell me.
The comm stuff. Really, the only thing I was doing was translating on the radio. I was part of the op center there, and they had an ongoing thing going down, and it was just really neat to be part of the process. But it was working with JIATF East, which is the Joint Interagency Task Force East. And you got to see how the sausage was made in the counter drug war. How everything from the politicians to like the DEA to the host nation to the army and the foreign forces all kind of come together to kind of combat narcotics folks, you know, narcos and stuff. And it was pretty interesting.
So we
would do 12 ons, 24 offs. So during one of the shifts, I remember it was me and this El Salvadorian Ranger commando guy or whatever. And we're out there like at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Out there being?
Oh, yeah. We were sitting in this narcotics base.
Okay.
Like the police base. And we were just plotting and manning a SATCOM radio. And we were talking to a PC and a C-130 from the Coast Guard. And they were kind of like the assets that we would kind of relay information to. And we would get intel from different things that would be happening out in the water. Like, you know, these guys passed to us that there was a go-fast. And a go-fast is these boats where people move drugs on. And I was like, wow, this is the real deal, though. So I'm talking to the El Salvadorian counterpart. And I'm trying to plot this thing on the map to see where this boat is and pass the word to, like, the Coast Guard and the PC so they could chase this thing down. And
PC being the patrol craft.
Yeah, oh, San Diego based patrol craft.
Yeah, yeah.
And I passed the word or whatever, and we're like, man, that's pretty cool. We're high fiving. And it dawned on me, you know, I go back and I just learned how to do this plotting stuff. Well, I didn't know how to plot stuff on the map at the time, but you know, they taught us, and I was like, okay, cool, I could do that. And I go to look again, and apparently El Salvador is in Central America. Well, the RPC was in the Pacific, and this go-fast was in the Gulf. So there was no way this PC was getting on that go-fast. And I had passed the word thinking that I had plotted this thing in the Pacific when actually it was in the other side of the country. But anyway.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, that was that. But,
did you get an ass chewing for that?
Oh, what, a NAM?
No, I know.
No. Nobody knew. It's sort of like, it's like, it really is not easy what these guys do. I don't know what the technology is like now, but it's really, really hard what the Coast Guard does, what these guys are doing when they're checking. It's literally, you really have to have a big screen of patrol craft, you know, to do this stuff. What I witnessed, it's not an easy thing to really catch these boats, but they're out there doing it.
And they're getting fancier and fancier.
Oh, yeah,
the
yeah,
they got the submarines. Yeah.
Yeah, that stuff's out there. And not to mention the rest of it. It was a big operation. So it was, they were catching, El Salvador is a big transit point. So all those drugs coming out of South America, they're all rolling on trucks up to Mexico and crossing the border that way. But they're also going through boats and kind of bouncing around from boat to land. It's like FedEx for narcos.
Just easy money for them.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so you spent a month in there. Any other detachments that you did just
at the time? Yeah, so I would, after that, I kind of caught the bug, and I was working as a defense contractor as a civilian, so I would answer up for whatever they needed at the time. So when if they were, I worked a lot with TRADET, which is the training detachment. So as platoons would go up and do their workups, like just like a ship in the fleet, these guys got to hit certain widgets. So as they're hitting their widgets, you know, like a CQB course or a breacher course or a JTAC course.
JTAC.
JTAC being the guys that call in ordnance on folks. Yeah, joint tactical air control.
Yeah, the guys that are calling on bombs to kill people.
Yeah,
blow people up.
Yeah. So for a lot of these courses, they always needed support, whether it's like pulling parachutes out of the water when these guys jump, playing op for these guys when they're practicing.
Opposing force.
Yeah, when they're practicing, you know, assaulting cruise ships or whatever. Mm-hmm. Not cruise ships, but cargo ships and things like that. I would have, at the time I was going to school and working as a defense contractor, so I'd have a lot of time on my hands to just kind of go back and do this sort of stuff. And I found if I was fun for me. So, you know, I'd play op, I played the bad guy or whatever. So we'd go down to these training places and the guys really appreciate it. Just to have a target, just to have a body to throw around. It was fun. It's good times.
Throw you around.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
They beat the shit out of you?
It would either be them or sometimes us. We'd have part of the training detachment. There's a red suit, a red man suit. And you've seen these things in like those self-defense courses. So sometimes we'd get into the red suit. And, you know, if you know, hey, you're the guy in the red suit, you know, that guy's coming at you. And we'd do things like these guys would enter a room and we'd grab their guns. Well, you know, and the good thing about team guys is they could take a hit. So you can.
Yeah, but they also can give a hit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, they're practicing things like muzzle strikes and stuff like that. And everybody got a little froggy, but it was it was fun. I guess there's a pun there. But yeah, it was fun because you know, it's good training for them to have people that are game to play and really be good targets. But, you know, you'd have everything from simunition.
Yeah, fake rounds, all that stuff, yep.
For the mount courses to, you know, the red suit to actually have these guys actually have to figure out how to detain somebody. You know, at the time I was doing jiu-jitsu and Thai boxing, so I was pretty game for it because I was okay with, you know, somebody swinging or something like that. It was fun to me, and it was a blast. We did a lot of that stuff. I also, it's a funny story there. We used to have this training, I called it Brown Cell, where at SEAL Team 4, we'd have Mexican Marines coming to Norfolk for training. Mexican Marines would do counter-drug training with the guys in Norfolk, and we'd have them for 8 weeks. And during that time, we ran them through a lot of the same scenarios, doing a lot of counter-drug training, and it was good times, good times.
Yeah. You did all these crazy and interesting trainings, courses, and all that stuff in the reserves. Did you retire from the military?
I retired from the reserve side.
What did you retire as?
Oh, first class.
First class. So you did your 20 years.
I did 22, actually. I stayed in Naval Special Warfare after up to 9/11, the September 11th attacks. It was a lot of the TRADET stuff in Naval Special Warfare.
I want to take a step back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So you talked about 9/11. Mm-hmm. How did that impact you as a reservist and you being in the military, somebody that really wanted to serve this country? How did 9/11 impact you as an individual?
Oh, yeah. Well, being from New York, you know, I watched it on television unfolding. I was at my office. I was a defense contractor. And I remember the guy in the cubicle over from me and said, "Hey, man, a plane just hit the World Trade Center." And I remembered kind of racking my brain that there was a plane that hit the World Trade Center before. It was a Cessna back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, well, you know, that's not the first time that's happened. And then when he said, "Dude, there's another one that just hit." And that's when I kind of knew that it was a terrorist attack. I said, when he mentioned that, and then I'm not sure if we got called down, but we went down to the conference room where there was a television in there. And then we watched it all unfolding. And, you know, we watched it like everybody else. And then, you know, then we heard about the attack on the Pentagon and, you know, Flight 93. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and at the time, nobody knew what else was up there. You know, there could have been a dozen of these planes. So, and I had, you know, tons of friends and family in New York. I had friends, that were in the World Trade Center during the bomb attack, the IED that went off.
93.
Yeah. When that IED went off, I had friends that were like racing out of the building. I'd hear stories about folks that were told, hey, you know, the plane hit a building, but it's the other building. So they started moving back up to their office spaces. And also we got some real heroes. Some of the guys in my reserve units were firefighters from New York, and they actually were there for the whole thing. A real good friend of mine, he lost a lot of his brothers there, and he'd be somebody to interview. Let me tell you, I don't want to throw his name out there, but I'll tell you afterwards, and we'll get a hold of him. He's a great, great guy. He's a real patriot that, you know, he was there for 9/11 as a firefighter, and he served with me as a CB after 9/11 for everything that came afterwards.
9/11 happens. What happened to you?
So I was ready to go back on active duty. The
literally the second you saw those towers hit, were you ready to just, I'll surf another 20, fuck those guys?
Yeah, it was at the time, it was, you know, I hit the 10-year mark.
Okay.
I was hitting the 10-year mark, and I was in the reserves, and I was enjoying what I was doing. And after those attacks, I was like, well, you know, I guess we're going to go kick somebody's ass. I don't know whose ass it is, but it's going down. And one of the things that happened was at the time was we were trying to find, you know, we would get the information as it trickled in about Osama bin Laden and his organization and weapons of mass destruction. And all of this went down for us. We had a big brief at the community about, you know, yellow cake and all of this stuff. And a guy comes to me while I was leaving the auditorium, and he's like, hey, you're Roman. It's like, you're getting ready to get recalled. You better, you know, get your shit in order. And I was like, really? I hadn't heard anything of it. And at the time, I was working. I was going to school. I was in the process of starting a new business. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, how do you know I'm getting recalled? You know, I haven't heard anything from it. And this was literally outside the building. And he's like, well, there's a guy over there now. And this was after they raided Afghanistan. They said, there's a guy over there now who's getting ready to have a baby. There's a guy over there who's getting ready to PCS. And there's a guy over there who's getting ready because he's been there for too long. Then I was like, well, damn, that's three kind of good reasons for me to jump in there. But I was game. So weird thing about the reserves is that it's almost like a union hall, at least the way we worked it at the NSW, where you don't get recalled as a unit. You get recalled as onesie twosies, and they find places for you to plug in.
Especially if your skill set lies into what they need.
Yeah. Right, right. And that's why the community was kind of like really liking the reserve side of the unit rolled over from being a detachment to being an operational support team to support all the East Coast teams and boat teams. And then it eventually went through three iterations, commissioning and decommissioning. Eventually it turned out they named it SEAL Team 18, and that's the reserve team. And from there they would put these expeditionary support elements, they'd call them. And you'd get attached to a team that would, a team turns into a squadron 6 months about prior to deployment. That's an EXW question if you ever have it. But as the command gets ready to deploy, they get other assets attached to it, you know, air assets, army mm-hmm. assets, things to help and support the mission. Because the Navy doesn't have the sort of total package like that a MU would have, or that the Army would have with conventional yep. forces mm-hmm. to support it. They don't have air assets. Yeah. They don't have special operations capable birds to do stuff. So a lot of times they get augmented with all these support elements. And what we were supporting, what we would do is we would get chopped over to the command, and we would get kind of divvied up between the troops and attached to a platoon as a sort of the support element. But I digress. So this was Iraq at the time. They told me I was getting ready to be mobilized. You know, I told my job. I was at school at the time, so I had to drop out of school. You know, you got to get somebody to cut your grass, take care of your mail, and do all that. You're like a Minuteman trying to roll back into your military life. And then I waited and I waited and I waited. And then 1 week went by, and a second week went by, and it didn't happen. And then eventually it did happen, and I was called to active duty, and I was back at Little Creek supporting. And then eventually it would go on for weeks and weeks where they were saying, hey, we're getting ready to shoot you out the door. You're going to Iraq, you're going to Afghanistan or whatever. And then they would not send me.
Yeah.
And then eventually I got demobilized, but then I ended up going on orders. Like I ended up, rather than being on actually mobilized active duty, they put a set of orders together and me and another guy, a chief, rolled out to Iraq on just a set of ADT orders, they call them in the reserves.
Interesting.
And we were out the door and doing that stuff. Yeah.
You were deployed to Iraq. You retired during the reserves. Mm-hmm. What, because it sounds like you were just due support, so you probably didn't see too much action in Iraq, and maybe I'm wrong in saying that, but.
No, Iraq was, and the thing with NSW is that they don't, you know, NSW is sort of like the scalpel.
Uh-huh.
You know, so these guys are, they do a very specific thing, and that's like capture and kill bad guys. You know, they don't, you'll see team guys out there, you know, but they're not the guys that are going to, they're not the unit that's going to take back Fallujah. You know what I mean? They're the guys that are going to go in there and kick the door in and, you know, take that top level leader.
They're not the
QRF. Like
right. They're not the QRF. They're not they're in and out and done. Mm-hmm. Next mission.
Our base in Iraq was pretty much Camp Habaniya, and we kind of lived out of there. And just supported the dudes out of there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Mm-mm-mm.
Did you meet any like Mike Murphy and any of the anybody interesting?
Those cats were there. They were, you know, like some of the guys are gone on to write books and things like that. They were there, but we all kind of just all did our own job. Like, you know, I think this was the same deployment Chris Kyle was on, or this was the same deployment that who else? Some of the other guys that were
so
out
you
there.
May have interacted, but it was just like, I'm sorry, I'm
it's
busy
all doing- work related.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. And those guys were doing their job just like I was doing ours. It was never, and at the time everybody was just doing their own thing. It was sort of like you know, if you had any interactions, it was just around chow hall, or maybe if you had we had jujitsu mats and tie pads and we'd train, that sort of stuff would go on. But
wait, did you ever meet Jocko Willink out there?
Jocko Willink, I think, was prior to that deployment or around the same time of that deployment. I do remember his, you know, you can't miss that guy. And I do remember him, you know, around the talk or something like that. I'm not hanging out as a second class. I'm not hanging out with, I think he was a commander or something, you know.
SEAL commander, let
yeah,
alone.
Yeah, task unit commanders. So, you know, if we had any interactions, it would probably be a whole lot of yes or no, sir. You know, I mean, even though it's pretty informal.
Right, because he did jujitsu out there, if I'm not mistaken. So I just didn't know if you're rolling and he was out there.
He
so.
Actually, I think he got his black belt in Norfolk from a guy out of Norfolk. I believe he was on the East Coast and he trained out of there. Because I remember him seeing it. I kind of remember him more in a gi than a uniform, but I do remember seeing him in the uniform, and I have seen him in the gi, so... at the time, so it's sort of like some of the same circles, but we're not buddies or anything like that.
Finish your deployment. You finish your reserve duty. What talking about kind of your deployment? Looking back, your 22 years of being in the military. What is probably the one or two memorable or funny stories that you haven't shared that you think needs to be talked about?
The last deployment. So we come back from Iraq, and I had mobilized again. I mobilized again after that and then a third time. And then my last mobilization was because I told my master chief, I was coming up on like, I don't know, 18 years in Navy. And I told my master chief, he's like, hey, I want to go out the door one more time. And they were getting ready to support a squadron going to Afghanistan with SEAL Team 10. And I was all about doing that. And that would have been my twilight tour. So I hit the 20-year mark with Team 10. And they were doing a different kind of mission. We were doing a VSO mission out there where we were living indige with the local population. And that's something that I think was new for everybody. You know, it's typically an SF mission, a Green Beret type of mission to live with the locals and kind of win hearts and minds. So we were out there and there was a platoon, a squad of army guys and maybe three or four techs. Techs are what they call guys in the teams that aren't team guys.
Uh-huh.
So where's gunner's mates, a CB, intel guy, maybe a comms guy. So there was like four of us and plus the platoon, plus the army guys. And we did our last deployment out there. That was 2011, 2012. And it was actually, I think, the longest deployment NSW's ever done. So I believe I was out there for about 11 months and they ended up being out there for another month. they did about 11 to 12 months there, and I ended up coming back because I was going to be demobilizing, mm-hmm. and I didn't have enough time left to. I was about to be a civilian out in Afghanistan if I didn't get back because my orders were about to expire. So I hit the 20-year mark out there. And the funny thing was that, and there's a picture of this on my Facebook page, that when we hit the 20-year mark, everybody that had a flag flew it around the village on that
American
day.
American flag.
American flag, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So for everybody else, it was a 10-year anniversary after the attacks on 9/11. Mm. For me, it was like the 20-year.
Literally
mark since I joined the Navy. So I have a picture there where everybody flew a flag. And I had a flag I flew everywhere I went. So my retirement flag, if you look at my shadow box, that thing was in Iraq, Afghanistan. I got to fly it when we hung Saddam Hussein. And I flew it when we on my last deployment on the 10-year, after the 10 years after 9/11. So, yeah. So that was pretty cool.
I'm definitely going to share that picture because for you that has more meaning besides 9/11 because you joined the military on 9/11 when that happened. That brought a new meaning to 9/11 for you.
Absolutely.
Retiring brought a new meaning to, or 20 years brought a new meaning being on deployment.
Indeed it did. It was a crazy time, but the time goes fast. You know, after, you know, when you hit those mile markers, you realize that all of a sudden you're the old guy now. And you look around and even these guys, I was, when they all got back and we all got back together and everybody had shaved and cleaned up, you realize how young everybody else was. And at the time it didn't dawn on me that I was one of the older dudes there. But I felt it.
I'm sure you did. Any other funny, memorable stories or just parting thoughts on your time in the service, any funny stories, et cetera? Just
the time goes fast. I mean, the thing about it of my last deployment was that they have a fighting season. Once that thing kicked off, we got into a tick about every 6 to 8 days.
A tick being a firefight.
Troops in contact is what you call it in on the radio. From the first time that happened to, and it's already like after winter and the snow melts and March comes around, all of a sudden, all hell breaks loose, the shit hits the fan. Yeah. And it's like you got everything from drive-bys to IEDs to just a whole lot of heinous stuff that just happens. And after a year of that stuff, it was an interesting experience because you come back with all your fingers and toes, and a lot of guys didn't.
Cannot imagine.
It was a crazy experience. I'm glad I lived through it and I did it. And it was like the perfect, icing on the cake for my time. But the time goes fast. Yeah, I came back and I rolled back over to Team 18 and spent about another year and a half and eventually started working towards getting the hell out and retiring and getting my weekends back.
Well, I appreciate your service too. I'm so glad that we got to sit down and record this and kind of hear your side. I had known some of the stories that you had shared because we had talked about this when we were in Detroit and, mm-hmm. and in Texas and probably Disney World this year or next year.
Oh, Disney World.
Shout out to Jesse, not connecting us, but just like, wow, this is a small world. So just to reiterate, like, I really appreciate you sharing your story and sharing these funny stories. You're a comedian now, or you do that?
Yes, we are. Yes. Comedian with ASAP, the Armed Services, our partnership that provides comedy boot camp, improv, and creative writing classes for veterans in the community.
We've had, I had a list of people that I wanted to have on when I first started this, and you were definitely on that list.
What?
And so it's been probably six months, trying to get you on this. And you live in Norfolk, and I now having a kid, there's no way I'm going to be traveling to Norfolk just mm-hmm. to do a podcast. You're a great guy, but my son takes definitely
that. Yeah. No, definitely. How old's your kid now?
8 months.
8 months. Man, that's a great time. They grow so fast.
Wait, by the time this comes out, he'll probably be a year old. No, probably 8 months. So I do appreciate you sharing your story, talking about your experiences, because everybody does have that unique experience. So from the bottom of my heart, you've always been a great friend since I've known you. And I'm excited to hear the response from your stories, but it was fantastic to actually put it down in audio form on.
Yeah, this has been great. This has been awesome. Thank you for the opportunity to share. And for those veterans out there, tell them to stay connected, tell their story, share their story. That's the best thing they could do.
Awesome. Totally agree. All right. Till next time.
Till next time.
And that's it for this week's podcast. Huge thank you to Jose. Kind of a weird story, but we actually met randomly when we were both deployed to Detroit through the Mission Continues. Come to find out, he's actually good friends with a former coworker of mine. So just small world, awesome to reconnect. If you ever get a chance, check out his comedy. Super hilarious, dude. But thank you so much for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Appreciate the support for not only myself, but would appreciate your support for Jose as well as he continues on to his comedic journey, I guess you could say. Be sure you are leaving a review on iTunes. I don't have anything else. That was an awesome episode. Thanks so much. I'll see you next week. My name's Alan, and you've been listening to Barrack Stories.